Okay, well, tonight we are going to talk about the English Reformation. And we're rapidly wrapping up this class that's been about the lessons from the Christian past. We started way back, like at the first century, talked about the rapid development of the church in the second century, missions, and we got to that point in time where in the fourth century, Christianity went from being a illegal religion that, you know, you kind of had to, you know, worship like this, and it went to being illegal to being the legal religion, and then just a few years later became the dominant religion. It became connected with the state, and if you were in power, then Christianity was your religion. And we see that through the Middle Ages. We've also chronicled and looked at the decline in the church. We've seen the simple faith of the New Testament be replaced with layers and layers and layers of traditions, some of which were brought in from Roman religion, some of which were snuck in from Germanic concepts of gods and demons and all this kind of thing. And then on top of that, more traditions piled, and until finally we've got, just the last 4 weeks or so, got to that point where some people said, maybe we ought to go back to the Bible and go back and look at what the Bible says about all these things, and that's what we call the Reformation. And so we've been talking about that. We've talked about Luther. We've talked about John Calvin and Zwingli. We talked about the Anabaptists a few weeks ago, the radicals of the Reformation. And now we're going to jump across the English Channel, okay? And in Reformation studies, there is the Continental Reformation, and then there's the English Reformation. And they're different in many ways, okay? And so I want to talk about the English Reformation tonight. And, you know, its story and what happens in England affects America quite heavily, okay? A lot of the things that you remember from early American history are synonymous, or they're very close in time to what we're talking about here. In fact, we'll be talking a little bit about Puritans tonight, which, as you know, make a big impact in New England and have shaped the American identity to this very day. Okay, many people, if you go to Europe and you talk with people, they still talk about those puritanical Americans, right? Who are still wearing the black hats and, you know, that kind of thing. Even though we decry the secularism in our culture, when you go to Europe, then you really see what secularism looks like. They think, you know, that we're so prudish, so puritanical, because we don't let women bathe nude, you know, or something like that, like they do in France. And so, I mean, it's very, I guess they do in some places here, but, I mean, for the most part in America, you don't do that kind of thing. They still refer to us as the puritanical Americans on the continent. So we'll talk about that tonight. All right, the English Reformation is different in many ways because many have said, if it wasn't for that guy and his problem, then we might not have had an English Reformation. Okay? And I know many of you know what his problem was. What was his problem? He couldn't get a male offspring. Okay, yeah, that's the short answer. Legitimate. I was going to say, he couldn't get a male offspring from the right woman, okay, which was his wife. And so this is a major problem that will spark the Reformation. But it would be wrong to say that there weren't any precursors, there wasn't any desire for Reformation in England prior to Henry's problem, okay? Because there were some. And we might point to guys like John Wycliffe, who died in the year 1384. He is usually seen as a precursor to the Reformation. He's back in the late Middle Ages, and he's a professor at Oxford, and he had some crazy ideas. One of the crazy ideas he had was that people could read the Bible in English, you know? So he made a translation of the New Testament, and this was just, you know, not acceptable. If people have the Bible in their own language, then who knows what they'll do with it, right? It's a very dangerous thing to let people read the Bible in their own language. They may misinterpret it, okay? And so that was the theory. Well, he said, fully on that, you know, I'm going to translate this. I want people to be able to read it, at least the literate class. He also condemned things like the papal authority. I mean, look at his date. He's way before the Reformation. He also said the doctrine of transubstantiation remember the doctrine of the real presence, you know, the switching, the substance of Christ becomes, you know, in the substance of the bread and the wine. He said that's not scriptural and so forth. So he led a little movement in England and centered around Oxford, and his followers eventually were called Lollards. Lollards. And the origin of that is a little bit obscure, but you know, they went around, you know, quoting the Bible and so forth, and some people, I guess, accused him of, I don't know, lollygagging or something, or I can't remember what the origin is, but we don't really know for sure anyway. But they're still in existence by the 16th century. And so when the reforms come in the 16th century, there's already a group that's ready. They are considered heretics, and they're going to be chased down. John Wycliffe actually died a nice ripe old age, and the church wasn't able to condemn him and get him burned at the stake. But a few years later, 25, 30 years later, I think, they actually dug up his bones and burned him after he was dead to kind of make the point, you know. So, anyway, now, coming along much later, we would be wrong to not mention William Tyndale's Bible. He is an early reformer in England who, again, wants the Bible to be in English. This is forbidden in the 1520s, so he's going to have to go across the continent, or across the English Channel, and get it translated and printed in the on the continent. I picked this up, a few months ago, and I thought I would pass this around. If you're interested, you could kind of glance at this. This is, I love these little charts that take very complex topics and put them on, you know, like that. Now, sometimes that's dangerous, but these guys, Rose Publishing, does a pretty good job with that. And so, and Tyndale is mentioned on there. Actually, his picture's on the front. I thought I would just pass that around. And by the way, any of these resources that you would like to use for further study, just feel free to ask me. Okay. So he will publish the Bible, and these Bibles will actually be snuck across the English Channel into England, you know, kind of like people smuggle cocaine, you know, from Mexico into America, you know. They're smuggling Bibles in. And some of you may have had this experience, or you know of missionaries back in the 50s and 60s in the Eastern Bloc that were smuggling Bibles into the Eastern Europe. Rex, maybe you even did that yourself. I don't know. You can't talk about it. Okay. They might still come and get you. But, you know, we did those kind of things into the communist bloc countries, and that's what Tyndale, his Bibles were smuggled in, and they were sold on the black market and so forth. So there is some precursors, but the real thing that gets things going is Henry VIII's marital problem. And it's kind of complex, and I don't know if it's worthwhile, if we can gain too much edification from understanding why exactly Henry had such a problem getting a divorce, but let me see if I can't take a minute to explain it, okay? He married Catherine of Aragon, who was a Spanish princess. Okay, so just imagine Spain, let's see. Okay, England up here. Well, England up here, Spain down there somewhere, okay? And so a Spanish princess comes to England back in the late 15th century to make a connection with the Tudor dynasty. And she marries the young Prince Arthur, right? The problem is there's some questions as to whether or not they actually consummated the marriage, whatever. He dies. But that was a great match. And it was a good political alliance between England and Spain, right? And so the dad says, well, hey, I've got another son, Henry. Why don't you marry him? And so they get married and everything is fine. All right? Now, in order to do that, they had to get a papal, from the Pope, a special permission. Okay? Because according to a passage in the book of Leviticus, you're not supposed to marry your brother's wife. Right? And that's very potent, you know, you don't do that. And that was part of canon law. That was, you can't do that. So, but the Pope could set that aside. It's called special dispensation. Okay, but later on, Henry cannot get a legitimate heir from Catherine. I mean, she's, you know, the poor woman, she's very pious, very, you know, God-fearing woman. She's had several miscarriages and stillbirth and so forth, and a female child, but not a male child, okay? And I don't even know how many times, you know. Anyway, so he gets the idea that maybe God has cursed him. Maybe he has been living in sin all these years, because of the book, what that passage in the book of Leviticus, and he begins to look for a way in the late 1520s to get the Pope to annul the marriage. Not get a divorce, but to declare that the marriage never actually took place. Okay? But this time the Pope says, I'm not going to do it. Okay? Now, some of you guys know this. I can tell by the light in your eyes, you remember this. So why can't the Pope just do it again? There's religious and political reasons why.
Catherine's brother was the
husband. Well, it's actually her nephew. Her nephew.
Everybody loved Catherine. She was the favorite.
Okay.
They didn't want to.
Okay, yes. You mean like the people in England? Yeah, okay. All right, let's start with that one. Remember Charles? Remember the movie Luther? That I showed you that clip of the Diet of Worms where he gives his great speech and the young guy sitting on the throne? That's Charles. He is the nephew to Catherine. Okay? And you think, well, big deal. He's the Holy Roman Emperor. How does that affect the Pope or England? Well, if the Pope were to annul that marriage, that would tick him off, Charles V. Okay? And in the mid-1520s, his armies had just gone to Rome and crushed the Pope's armies. The Pope was held captive for a little while. The city of Rome was ravished by the imperial troops. And you think the Pope is then going to make him even more mad by disrespecting, dissing his aunt? Not going to do it. Okay. Not going to do it. On top of that, in England, she was quite popular, with especially women. What does that say to the women of the country if the king just sets her aside because she can't have a male or whatever? So, but there's a religious reason why the Pope. This is why dates matter. I tell my students, dates matter. Okay, why in the late 1520s is it a religious problem for the Pope to say the previous Pope that said it was okay for you to marry your brother's wife? Well, he was wrong, basically. Why is that a problem? I'm sorry? Okay. Yeah, I mean, that would be to say that the previous Pope made a mistake. And what's Luther been saying? Yeah, Luther's been saying they make mistakes all the time. Councils make mistakes. Councils err. Therefore, we've got to only follow the Bible, because it doesn't make any mistakes. But popes make mistakes, councils make mistakes. You see how Henry's really in the spot. The popes can't do it. And plus, they keep turning over. The popes keep dying there in the 1520s, and they're not in very power very long. And so he keeps sending envoys back to Rome, and then they come back empty-handed, and he keeps waiting around. Janie's let me read a really interesting book right now. I finally got into the book. I'm like on page 220 or whatever. It's a very interesting book about this time period, so I'm enjoying that. But it kind of gets you into the little details of the life that Henry is living during this time. So he's not able to, but finally he will say, I've had enough. And one of his advisors, Thomas Cromwell, will eventually come up with the idea that, in England, the king should be supreme. And if the church and the state are basically connected, then doesn't it follow that the king should also be the head of the Church of England? And plus, you can't find the doctrine of the papacy in the Bible. And so he kind of pulls the Protestant card and then gets Henry what he wants, which is the divorce, essentially. Okay, and so that's the big story in England. 1534, Parliament passes this Act of Supremacy, which basically snips England off from the Catholic Church. And some people have said it's like it snipped it off right here, but it still was very Catholic in many ways. Okay, and so Henry will become the monarch of England, will become the head of the Church of England. Okay. All right. That wasn't 1 minute, but it was kind of close, right? Any questions about that, or anything I missed that you think is important, or
it's interesting that Thomas Cranmer was married to the late Archbishop of Canterbury.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right, it was a couple of years. Now, was he married again? Because I know his first wife had died, but I can't remember. I forgot about that, yeah. Yeah, so even in England, you're beginning to see the celibacy of the priesthood go away. Even at the highest level, Archbishop of Canterbury will become basically the top of the hierarchy in England, and then right above him will be the king. But the highest clergy member in the Church of England would be the Archbishop of Canterbury. Okay, still is today, by the way. Who is it today? Anybody know? Rowan Williams? Anybody ever heard that name? Yeah. I was just checking. I didn't know if he had died recently or whatever. But so when you hear the Archbishop of Canterbury say something in England, that's basically the Pope of the Church of England. I mean, Tony Blair and those other guys, the monarchs don't really do that much anymore. Okay. By the way, this is one of the big issues that the Church of England has had to deal with recently is the ordination of homosexuals. I don't know if you're aware of that. They're kind of, some in the church want to do that. And he's had to massage that issue a lot because the Anglicans in Africa are like, no way. We don't even agree with that practice at all, let alone the priest being gay. So the church in England is having to deal with the Anglicans that are out in the third world country, which are much more conservative than the Anglicans in England today. Okay, so well, there's a lot more of them. I mean, if you're in England, you're technically part of the Church of England, but you know what that means. You know, nobody goes. Churches are like museums and things like that. Okay, so Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be the top clergy member, but the head of the church will be the monarch of England, still the case today. Okay, Queen Elizabeth II. Okay, so, but the thing is, Henry is not really a Protestant in his bones. He needed to be, freed up. Okay, he was mainly concerned about making sure he had a male heir. And so he marries Anne Boleyn, and he's got a bunch of others that come after that too. But all he wanted was he wanted that, but the rest of English society and English church was pretty much Catholic. Okay, you wouldn't have really noticed much of a difference. In fact, he persecuted some Protestants that were going too far, were criticizing some doctrines such as transubstantiation. It's not until he dies in 1547 and his son, Edward, takes over, a very young boy, takes over, who was raised a Protestant, and then he brings these real Protestants to power, guys like Thomas Cranmer, who will really, he allows him to really make England more Protestant. And that's when, for about 6 years there, you have the real beginning of a reform movement in England. And one of the things that happens is that a common prayer book will be written that will become the liturgy for the English church that is truly Protestant in the things that you would read and that you would pray. It gets rid of the Catholic doctrines out of there. And I've got a modern Book of Common Prayer. This is actually from the Episcopal Church. Bill brought this to me one day. And I'm going to pass that around, but you might gently look in it because it's kind of fragile. It's over 100 years old. You can look through some of the titles and you can see what the Common Book of Prayer is. It basically takes chunks of Scripture and puts them to be read at certain times and certain days and so forth. But they're still following the church calendar and so forth. And so that's the Book of Common Prayer, which really marks the beginning of a Protestant movement. And then the 42 Articles is one of the early, essentially a creed of the English church that identifies the Protestant nature of this of the Church of England. But, as you know, things go back, right? You've heard of Bloody Mary? Like they have a mixed drink called the Bloody Mary? Don't they? Right? I mean, okay, good. I didn't dream that up, so. But anyway, Edward dies. He's a weakly, sickly boy, and he dies. And they're looking around for who's the legitimate heir to the throne. Well, Mary has been living, I think she was living in France or someplace, and she's the oldest daughter. She was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, and she claims the throne. Comes across, and the English say, yeah, she's the legitimate ruler. Comes back, she's a hardcore Catholic. I mean, she's like, we're turning back the clock, you know? You ever done that? Like, was it leap forward day? No, leap backward. Whatever it is, you turn the clock back. I mean, that's, you know, she turns the clock back and persecutes the Protestants for during her reign, which is not that long. Actually, that's those dates aren't right. She reigned longer than that. There's a typo. She reigned 5 years. So 1558 is the date should be. Persecuted many Protestants. The number we usually use is 300. There were 300 people in 5 years that were burned at the stake as heretics, Protestants under Mary Tudor. Okay, and that's why she got the title Bloody Mary. And some of the famous ones, and that's what this woodcut is going to depict, would be, in fact, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer himself. And this is where England gets some of its great moments in the Reformation, where there are three church leaders, Ridley, Cranmer, and I just blanked out, there's another one, who were all burned at the stake at Oxford and right during this time period. And if you go to Oxford today, there's a monument in the ground that shows you right where they were burned at the stake. Thank you, Latimer. Thank you. Yeah, I keep her around. She helped me with names. And they were all burned at the stake right around the same time. But the problem was, you know, Cranmer had kind of weakened. When they tell you they want you to recant and take it back, they play on your emotions and so forth, and you're going to burn at the stake. And he actually did take it back. He recanted his Protestant beliefs, but then felt bad that he had done that. I mean, when you see other people burning at the stake and you can smell their flesh burning, I mean, we need to be graceful toward those people who, under the pressure, say, I think I'm not a Protestant. I'm a Catholic now. I mean, it doesn't make it right, but it just, you can understand. But he felt bad about that, and he had signed a document indicating his taking that back. But then he changed his mind, and so they did eventually lead him out to be burned at the stake. And the story goes, and there are witnesses that said this is true, several witnesses, that when the fires began to leap up, he said, I'm going to hold out my hand. May the hand that offended, meaning that signed the recantation, that's the hand that's going to burn first. So he held it into the fire, and that's what that is indicating up there. He's holding it out. So if you see a picture of somebody holding their hand out in the fire like that, that's him. And if you go to Oxford today, when you go, there's a beautiful little traffic circle there, and there's a wonderful shrine to these three men there. It's not in the exact place where they burned at the stake. You have to go down toward the Bodleian Library, and there's a little plaque. It was in a ditch, actually, just where they were burned. So there were quite a few martyrs. 7%, they say 7% of those who died during the period of the Reformation as heretics were martyred during Mary's 5-year reign. So it was a very short and bloody reign. All right, now, but then she dies. She was kind of older, and she had some kind of a tumor or something, and she was trying to get a male heir for England that would be Catholic. She actually had married the king of Spain, Philip, who was like the arch-Catholic. I mean, he's like, no Protestants in my country. I mean, he made a statement. He said, I would rather lose all of my kingdoms, all of my realms, and 1,000 more if I had, I'm really paraphrasing now, rather than be the ruler of one heretic. So he wants them all gone. Okay. And so she's marrying him, trying to bring England, you know, really back into the Catholic fold. But she dies. And then who comes to the throne? The next daughter in line, which is Elizabeth. And Elizabeth will take the throne, and we usually say that with Elizabeth, England finally will be in the Protestant camp and really doesn't ever look back. It's going to stay Protestant from that point forward. Okay? So not that she was really a diehard Protestant. We usually say she was a politique, you know, she kind of, you know, did that. Okay, yeah, well, the winds are blowing Protestant. Let's go that direction. And we need to be Protestant, even though she, to the day she died, used many Catholic phrases and so forth One that I was looking back over some of the stuff today that I'd forgotten about, but she used to say, make an oath sometimes by the body of God, okay, which was a very Catholic phrase to use, you know, referring to the host. And so, still Catholic in many ways, but she decided that England needed to be Protestant. Okay. Oh, I've got a picture of the... Yeah, that's the thing that in Oxford that shows you the... it's the shrine to the martyrs there. And then this is X marks the spot where they were actually burned at the stake, and which is down the road a ways. Okay? I guess that's supposed to be a cross. Okay, now, a few things about Anglicanism, the Church of England, that I think would be important to know. One is that the Church of England, the Anglican Church, is basically a mixture of Protestants and Catholics. Okay, you kind of put it together and you get kind of this middle of the road kind of Protestant religion that looks Catholic in many ways. Okay, but here are some of the things that are clearly Protestant. They reject the Pope. Okay, that's obvious from 1534 on. They also will agree with Luther that there's only two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper. They don't believe in, you know, penance and last rites and those kinds of things, marriage. Well, they believe in marriage, but not as a sacrament. Okay, and they also would reject transubstantiation, the doctrine of transubstantiation. Okay, so that's the Protestant side. But then there's the Catholic side. And they will retain an episcopal organization. What does that mean? The fancy word, episcopal organizational structure. What's an episcopos? That's a biblical word. Okay, bishop. All right. And that's all it means. They're going to keep the hierarchy. It's like they keep the hierarchy except for they just stop. The top is the king rather than the pope. Okay, so you still have bishops and then archbishops, and you know Archbishop Canterbury is the very top. So it keeps that structure, and then also the ancient creeds will be retained and a part of. They will confess those ancient creeds, the Nicene Creed, and so forth. Also, this is probably the one that you'll notice the most is the liturgical aspect. When you go to an Anglican church, if you don't know any better, you might think you're in a Catholic church. Okay? Anybody ever had that experience? Okay? Bob? Okay. What are some of the examples? What will be some things that look very Catholic?
The priest wears pretty much the same vestments.
Okay. Good.
There's an altar. The building inside looks a lot the same.
Right. Now, especially in England, because when the whole country goes over, there used to be a cathedral. Yeah, basically, you know, so you don't really have to change much at all. I mean, you know, it'd be like us, you know, selling our building to somebody, and they might keep a lot of what's here, and they might change it up or something like that. So a lot of the stuff stays the same, and this, it looks very, very Catholic. So the vestments, the priest will still wear the vestments. Anything else that you think of? You guys been to an Anglican church? Yes?
Don't they put the Lord's Supper in much the same way?
Yes. You mean like the actual partaking? Yeah. In many of them, you will come down front. You know, you kind of march down to the front and take it. I'm not sure if they take it on a quarterly basis or, I mean, definitely Easter time, you know, you would be taking a communion.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
Typically, they take it every Sunday.
In the Episcopal Church? Okay.
I had a friend who was a Episcopalian, and there's something about the physical mannerisms in which they know that you are not Episcopalian, and then they won't serve you.
Right, okay.
And I don't know what that is. Well, she wouldn't tell her or something.
It's a secret. Well, I mean, it may be one of those things where, you know, see a visitor walk in and you kind of look over there and we're singing 728B. You guys know that song, right?
Yeah.
Our God, He is alive, okay? And you look over there and they're like, you think, I ain't from the Church of Christ, right? I mean, it may be something like that, you know, that, you know, you go into Episcopalian church, you know, okay, you're going to stand at a particular point, then you're going to kneel, and then you stand again, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Is priest, you call him father?
You know, I don't know if you do that in the Anglican Church.
Yeah.
Do you call them father? And you call them father? Really? Okay.
There's like two or three different titles depending, I guess, the size of the church.
Okay. Now, I should say this too. I mean, in the current day Anglican Church and Episcopalian Church, you have high church and then you have low church. Okay? And I'm kind of referring to the high church, and that's what goes way back, you know, is, you know, very ritualistic, very, you know, you proceed through the service. When we were in Oxford and we went to an Anglican church service, just, you know, see how things are done, it was very formal. People were coming forward and people were laying down, you know, and taking the position of the cross before they took the Lord's Supper. I mean, it's very, very structured in that way. So, in the liturgy, except for that it's in English, and the vestments and other ritual actions, it looks a lot like the Catholic faith. But there were some who were saying, this is not Protestant enough. This looks like a dumbed down version of the Pope of the Church of Rome, and we want to make it really Protestant. And these guys are known as the Puritans. And they are going to be the hardcore. They call them the hot gospelers, who are really serious about the gospel. And they really wanted to get rid of things. They wanted to get rid of images. They wanted to get rid of any special chandeliers and kind of special stuff up in front. And they wanted just a very plain worship service that was simple. Okay, and this group begins to agitate under Elizabeth's reign. In fact, toward the end of her reign, she really gets ticked off at these guys, and it will be into... She dies in 1603, and shortly after that, they're kind of hoping that the next king might be a little bit more, you know, advantageous toward them, and he's not, you know. James the First, you know, King James, you know, some of your Bibles, King James, he wasn't very happy with the Puritans, he hated them. And then Charles, after him, wasn't very happy, so they say, we're out of here. Let's go to America. You know? And so that starts the American story. Okay, there's a scene here from a film that I have. It's called Cromwell. And this is not our Thomas Cromwell from the 1520s. This is Oliver Cromwell from the 1640s, who is a Puritan leader. And we're a little bit farther on than what we're talking about right now, but it gives you a feel. And this scene here is set out in the countryside. The Puritans were very strong out in the country, around Cambridge, that area to the north. And they wanted real reform, and in some areas, they were able to make it happen on the local level. So some of the areas they had actually tried to reform, but from time to time there would be edicts that would come down from the king saying, no, 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 we're all going to worship exactly the same way. And the Puritans didn't like that at all. And this scene illustrates that. They're actually enclosing some of the land, and Cromwell was actually a lower level gentry who had some men working on his land. And they go to church here, and you'll see him get very upset about some things that are put back into worship service. Okay, so the worship wars are not new to the Church of Christ. All right, I mean, you'll see a worship war right here, okay? And I have to pause it at a point because he says a bad word.
To the Earl of Manchester.
By whose authority?
By the authority of the king.
Then I say the king is a thief!
You're under arrest! Take him away!
Bastards!
Release that man! Who the devil are you? This man works for me. Whatever he has done, I will take full responsibility.
He has spoken treason against the king. Will you take responsibility for that?
The rights to pasture belong to the common people. By what authority, Lord Manchester, do you take that away?
By the authority of His Majesty's commissioners, granting me and my friends full rights to this land for the purpose of improvement.
Such a contract cannot be legal. It is in violation of the law of this land.
As a magistrate, you should know
Manchester. It is the king's duty to maintain the law. This is common land. It belongs to the people.
This is my land and you are trespassing. It's only out of respect for your rank I don't have you arrested for obstructing the law. Captain Lunsford!
My lord?
See that no unauthorized person enters this area.
Yes, my lord. Remove these people!
Simple black outfits as opposed to the fancy Anglicans.
Good morning, Police Squad. Good morning, Mrs. Crumble.
Squire, have you news of my husband?
Some God's hands, Mrs. Carter.
And of the King's.
Let us pray. Almighty God, look down upon this thy house and we thy humble servants. Grant us the spirit of thy grace through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Who has done this? Answer me. Who has done this?
An edict, Squire, from the Archbishop himself and by order of the King.
By order of the King? Is the Church of England not a Protestant church? Would the King turn the house of God into a Roman temple?
Mr. Cromwell, I beseech you.
Does the King think that God can be bought with gold, trinkets, and gilded rubbish?
I know only that I have been instructed.
Has this King forgotten the Reformation?
Mr. Cromwell, I...
Away with it. Popish idolatry!
Cut off his ears. We'll stop there. He says some choice things about the king right there. Anyway, but did you see, you know, he comes to church, he thought that the church had been reformed, at least in that area, and he looks up and he sees all of this stuff, and it looks just like a Catholic church, and he goes bonkers. Okay, so there were people that did this kind of thing talk about worship wars, you know, just imagine that. And, you know, in our history, the Restoration history, we have stuff like that happened too. You know, people coming in and stealing pianos and putting them in barns, and people come in, hey, where's the piano? Oh, somebody stole it, you know. And we do have some things like that in our history as well, but the Puritans were very serious. Now, one of the other things about the Puritans is that they weren't happy with the theological middle road. They wanted to be staunch Catholic. Calvinists. And so really keeping the law of Moses, I mean the Ten Commandments, you know, really holding tightly to that, which includes Sabbath keeping, by the way, will all be part of what American religion looks like. In the Northeast especially. So there were some who wanted to purify the Church of England, but even to this day, the Anglican Church is very much in the middle path. Okay, and by the way, especially in the late 20th century and the early 21st century, there are many Anglicans who are serious about their Christianity who are leaving the Anglican Church, and they're going to more conservative forms of Christianity to get holding on to very firm things, okay, because the Anglican Church, it kind of goes, it's very loose these days. Now, the American version of the Anglican Church is the Episcopal Church. And so, Fred, you grew up in the Episcopal Church, and so did Bill. That is basically the Anglican Church in America. And after the American Revolution, they changed the name. They didn't want to be called the Church of England because of obvious reasons. Okay, we just broke away from the Church of England. We don't want to be People don't want to go to church there, right? So, but in Canada, where we came from, you know, a few years ago, they still have the Church of England. You know, it's still there and so forth. I was saying people are leaving the Anglican Church, and this is quite a crisis. A few years ago, Melody and I went back to Michigan for a thing for about a month at a college back there and studied. And we had a good long conversation with some people who had recently converted to Catholicism, and they came from the Episcopal Church. And the reason was that the Episcopal Church, the Anglicans, were too liberal on moral issues such as gay marriage and abortion and all those kind of, you know, female priests and all the rest of it. And they said, we're looking for Christianity, you know, and they were going to Rome, unfortunately. They didn't feel like that evangelicalism was going anywhere either. But the point is that many Anglicans are getting out of it because there's not any not a lot of conviction there in many ways. So, okay. Next week we're going to wrap up this session, this series. One thing we haven't talked about is what the Catholics are doing during all of this. Okay, there is one last thing we want to talk about, which is what did the Roman Catholic Church do to reform itself in the 16th century? We call this the Counter-Reformation, or you could call it the Empire Strikes Back. You know, that's what I like to call it. They will get with it and make some reforms that are still basically are lasting into the 20th century. Okay, there's a major council in the 16th century, the Council of Trent, and right up until the 1960s, it is what defined the theology of Catholicism. Things changed in Vatican II in the 60s, but we won't get that far. Okay, we won't get that far. So what we're going to do, next week we're going to finish up, probably only take about 30 minutes to do that, and then I just want to just let's unpack a little bit and any questions you have from the whole scope of it. Maybe I'll provoke a few questions and then we'll be done with this. And then the next quarter we'll be doing something different. We have two different classes that will be offered on Wednesday night. One of them will be a textual class here, and then another one will be over in the fellowship hall, which is more of a topical discussion oriented class. And so what we'll do eventually down the road, if there's interest, I'll do American religion, what's happened since the Reformation in America specifically, and we'll do that for a quarter, and we'll do restoration stuff in that, as well as kind of where are we right now in American religion. There's some really interesting things going on, okay, within conservative Christianity, you know, emerging church and missional church and some of these things you've heard before. I want to try to put that in perspective, but we'll save that for a little bit later. So, okay, thank you for your attention, and see you next week. I will call attention to the fact that it is 7:30.